Hi, it's Scott. It is Tuesday, April 7th, and I am reading from the Tuesday, April 7th edition of USA Today. The top stories: a whole civilization will die tonight, Trump says, ahead of Iran deadline. This story is written by Michael Loria, a USA Today staff reporter. President Trump issued a stark warning to Iran on Tuesday that a wave of expected attacks on critical infrastructure would leave the country unable to recover. A whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again. I don't want that to happen, Trump said in an April 7th social media post. His stark warning comes after he threatened to take out the entire country on Monday with no signs of budging on a deal that would open the Strait of Hormuz. The entire country can be taken out in one night, and that night might be tomorrow night, Trump told reporters at the White House yesterday, repeating his 8 p.m. Eastern Time Tuesday deadline for Iran to make a deal. Trump added, every bridge in Iran will be decimated by 12 o'clock tomorrow night, meaning tonight. Every power plant in Iran will be out of business, burning, exploding, never to be used again. Strikes on Iranian energy and transportation infrastructure would mark a major escalation in the conflict. Experts have warned that the attacks on civilian infrastructure could be considered war crimes and could turn Iranian civilians against the United States. The countdown comes after Trump, on Easter Sunday, renewed an ultimatum for Iran to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, the waterway used to ship much of the world's oil. Since the U.S. and Israel launched the war back on February 28th, Iran has blocked oil shipments through the strait to drive up global fuel costs. On Tuesday morning, the average price of a gallon of gasoline across the United States had reached $4.14, according to AAA. Prices were considerably worse in some places, for example, in California, where the average price was $5.93 a gallon. The average price at the start of the year was $2.82 a gallon. Thousands of people across the Middle East have been killed in the war thus far. Tens of thousands of U.S. troops have been deployed to the region, and 13 military members have been killed thus far. Financial experts expect the war will slow global economic growth and drive up inflation. This story is headlined, Vice President Confirms U.S. Strikes on Karg Island. It's written by Christopher Kahn. The United States carried out multiple strikes on the island early Tuesday morning, according to Reuters and the Wall Street Journal, citing officials. American forces in March carried out strikes on the island where Iran's main oil export terminal is located. When asked about the newly reported strikes on Karg Island, Vice President Vance said the action does not represent a shift in U.S. strategy. He said, "We were going to strike some military targets on Karg Island, and I believe we have done so." That from Vance while speaking in Budapest on Tuesday. He added that, I don't think news on Karg Island represents a change in strategy or represents any change from the President of the United States. Vance also expressed hope that a deal can be reached between the U.S. and Iran before President Trump's 8 p.m. deadline tonight. I hope they're smart, the Vice President said, speaking during that same visit in Budapest. The president has set a deadline for about 12 hours from now, and we're going to find out. But there's going to be a lot of negotiation between now and then, he said, and I'm hopeful that it gets to a good resolution. Vance added that the United States has largely accomplished its military objectives and that, quote, very shortly, this war is going to conclude, unquote. Financial markets were choppy ahead of Trump's 8 o'clock p.m. deadline. Oil bounced with a barrel of Brent crude trading near $110 just before 9 a.m. Eastern Time, after falling to as low as $107 overnight. Stocks appeared set to open lower, and government bonds also sold off. The benchmark 10-year U.S. Treasury note was more than 2 basis points higher. Bond yields rise when prices fall, and investors have been selling bonds in anticipation of higher inflation caused by the war. And one final note on the war. A press briefing on the Iran conflict has reportedly been scrapped ahead of a threatened major escalation in the conflict. The briefing was expected to happen earlier this morning at the Pentagon, hours ahead of Trump's deadline for strikes on Iranian infrastructure. Pentagon Chief Pete Hegseth and General Dan Kane, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had been expected to lead the briefing. Journalists at multiple outlets, including Reuters and News Nation, reported on the cancellation. The Pentagon did not immediately respond to requests for comment on why officials scrapped the briefing. Here's an update on space travel. The Artemis II crew is flying back home. Now, this headline, Artemis II crew flies past moon's far side, now begins journey back to Earth. It was a busy day on the far side of the moon. The 4 crew members of Artemis II set a distance record for humanity on Monday as they flew beyond the lunar surface while over 250,000 miles from Earth. The astronauts are not only the first humans to venture near the moon since NASA's final Apollo-era mission back in 1972, at about 2 o'clock yesterday afternoon, the crew surpassed a record distance of 248,655 miles in space that was set in 1970 during the famous Apollo 13 mission, according to NASA. The crew also came up with 2 names for craters on the moon, the first in honor of their spacecraft, Integrity, and the second in honor of Mission Commander Reid Wiseman's late wife, Carol, who died in 2020 at the age of 46 after a 5-year cancer battle. The moment the crew announced the name Carol was filled with tears and a group hug. To top off an incredible day of space travel yesterday, the Artemis II crew witnessed a sublime solar eclipse visible only to them and no one back on Earth. "We just went sci-fi," mission pilot Victor Glover said during the roughly hour-long eclipse. "It just looks unreal." The eclipse, which was visible only to the 4 humans on the Orion spacecraft, started at around 8:30 last night and was expected to last for about an hour. "This continues to be unreal," mission pilot Victor Glover said as he watched the phenomenon unfold. "The Earth is so bright out there, and the moon is just hanging in front of us, this black orb out in front of us. We can see the stars and planets behind it. It is quite an impressive sight." The Artemis crew got back into communication with Mission Control and technically began its journey home. The 4-person crew experienced a planned period of radio silence after briefly losing contact with Earth for about 40 minutes before they came back online at around 7:30 last night. That temporary loss of communication came as the Orion spacecraft traveled behind the moon, which blocked its signal from reaching NASA's deep space network. The array of giant radio network antennas on Earth is responsible for maintaining communication with Artemis II and its astronauts aboard Orion. The crew yesterday also witnessed an Earthrise as Orion emerged from behind the moon, moments before the deep space network quickly reacquired the vehicle's signal and restored contact between it and Mission Control at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. In national news, the story is headlined, "American Woman is Missing, after husband says she was swept out to sea. Police on Monday searched for an American woman whose husband said she fell overboard from a boat in the Albaco Islands as the pair sailed in the Bahamas. The Royal Bahamas Police Force reported the woman's husband told authorities the couple had departed the island of Hopetown at about 7:30 a.m. local time on Saturday in an 8-foot hard-bottom dinghy boat headed for the nearby island of Elbow Cay. According to a news release from police, the man and his wife are from the United States. The husband said his wife fell overboard with the keys to the boat, causing its engine to shut off. Strong currents allegedly carried her out to sea, the agency reported, and the husband lost sight of her before he was able to paddle the vessel to shore. Police reported that the husband arrived at the Marsh Harbor Boatyard in Marsh Harbor at about 4 a.m. on Easter Sunday, and at that time alerted a passerby who contacted authorities. Officials did not say where the couple is from in the U.S. or identify her. Police said the search for the woman is ongoing. The story is headlined, "She was in active labor and refused a C-section. The hospital took her to court." Childbirth often goes differently than planned, but a Florida woman faced something truly unexpected while she was in labor, a virtual court hearing. In September of 2024, Cherise Doyle, a professional birthing doula and a pregnant mother of three, arrived at the University of Florida Health Hospital in active labor, according to reports from People magazine and ProPublica. Her plan was to try for a vaginal delivery, the report said, but staff were concerned about the risk of uterine rupture and suggested she give birth via a C-section. USA Today has reached out to the hospital for comment, but has not heard back. Uterine rupture is a rare but serious complication where the uterus can tear or break open, according to the Cleveland Clinic. It's most common in those who've had a previous cesarean section and then try for a vaginal delivery. In people who've had one cesarean delivery, it happens in about 1 in 300 deliveries, the clinic notes. Among people who've had more than one C-section, uterine rupture is more common, affecting up to 9 in 300 deliveries. According to ProPublica, Doyle, who had previous C-sections that led to complications, understood her risk for rupture to be less than 2% and told doctors she would not consent to a cesarean without first trying a vaginal delivery. Later, nurses arrived with a tablet pulled open to a virtual court hearing with a judge and other officials. In a recording of that hearing that was obtained by ProPublica, Doyle called it the craziest thing I've ever seen. She also asked if there was an African-American doctor that could be assigned to her care instead, to which the judge responded, "I don't find that race really has much to do with this." "It does have much to do with it, because historically, black people do better when they have health care providers that look like them," Doyle responded to the judge. "So, even though you don't think so, statistically speaking, I have a better chance of having better care from a BIPOC person." Maternal mortality rates are 3.5 times higher for black women than white counterparts, and experts say unconscious bias among healthcare providers does play a role. Research suggests that the remnants of the medical community's long history of racial bias persist in the modern day. For example, a 2016 study found that nearly half of first and second year medical students believed that black people have a greater pain tolerance, thicker skin, and feel less pain than white patients. Hours later, the judge did not order an immediate C-section, but ruled that the hospital could perform the surgery without her consent if an emergency arose. Overnight, doctors said the baby's heart rate dropped, ProPublica reports, and rushed Doyle into surgery, giving birth to her daughter via C-section before the baby was brought to the neonatal intensive care unit. "When we use the courts to basically strong-arm and bully someone into unnecessary medical procedures against their will, it's akin to torture, in my opinion, Doiley told ProPublica. The story is headlined, ICE arrested more than 800 people after tips from TSA. It's written by Reuters staff writers Ted Hessen and Christina Cook. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers arrested more than 800 people following tips that had been shared by federal airport security officials from the start of Donald Trump's presidency through February of this year. That's according to internal ICE data that's been reviewed by Reuters. That figure is far above what was previously publicly known. The leads came from the Transportation Security Administration, which supplied ICE with records on more than 31,000 travelers for possible immigration enforcement, according to the data. Reuters was not able to determine how many arrests took place inside airports, although the TSA tips would mainly be useful in determining when a person would be traveling. ICE and TSA are part of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. The agencies have historically shared information related to national security threats, but they began focusing on routine immigration arrests last year as part of the president's mass deportation effort. The 31,000 traveler records were gathered by TSA's Secure Flight Program, created in 2007 to allow the agency to review passenger information for people who may be on U.S. government watch lists. The program was intended as a counterterrorism measure, not to track down immigration offenders, according to the regulations that outlined its purpose. The Department of Homeland Security did not respond to requests for questions about TSA providing passenger information to ICE, but did say that under the Trump administration, TSA, quote, is pursuing solutions that improve resiliency, security, and efficiency across our entire system. Figures for arrests and traveler records that TSA shared with ICE before Trump's current term as president were unavailable. U.S. airports and immigration enforcement have been at the center of a partisan funding fight since mid-February. That's when Democrats refused to support additional money for Republican President Trump's immigration crackdown without reforms to scale back aggressive tactics. That standoff blocked the passage of a bill that funded DHS, which in turn caused TSA security officers to miss at least two full paychecks. After some unpaid TSA officers began calling out sick, Trump deployed ICE officers to more than a dozen United States airports last month to help security efforts. Democrats have criticized the deployment and called on the Trump administration to remove them. A group of more than 40 Democrats in the U.S. House wrote a letter to recently installed Homeland Security Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen last week that ICE officers, quote, will cause confusion and fear, unquote, if they are allowed to remain in airports. Several cases of ICE officers arresting travelers in U.S. airports have sparked a backlash. ICE officers detained a college student traveling from Boston to Texas to celebrate Thanksgiving in November and arrested a sobbing mother at San Francisco International Airport the day before Trump's airport deployment began. The Department of Homeland Security defended both of those arrests and said they were subject to final orders of removal. Reuters spoke with three immigration attorneys who said they were familiar with cases of people without legal immigration status being arrested in airports. Those cases included an Irish couple who had lived in the United States for more than 20 years and had been detained last summer by immigration authorities in front of their children when attempting to fly from Florida to New York after a vacation. That's from Christina Canty, one of the lawyers. She said that the parents who had pending applications for permanent residency were deported and left their two young children, ages 7 and 10, with adult siblings in the United States. In another case cited by one of the attorneys, a Chinese woman with a final order of removal who was seeking permanent residency in the United States was detained by ICE last year at the Atlanta airport en route to Philadelphia. This story is headlined, Bald Eagle Parents Hatch Their Second Chick on Easter. Famous eagle parents Jackie and Shadow's second egg officially hatched on Easter Sunday, giving fans and parents a second ball of fluff to watch and love. The chick, which is being referred to as Chick 2 until it is officially named, was hatched on April 5th at about 8:30 in the morning local time in Jackie and Shadow's nest, according to the Friends of Big Bear Valley and Big Bear Eagle Nest Cam at the Big Bear Valley Facebook page. That nest is located in the Big Bear Valley, a 15-mile valley in the San Bernardino National Forest in Southern California. The chick's hatching was caught on camera the morning after its older sibling, known as Chick 1, hatched on April 4th at 9:30 in the evening. Chick 1 was receiving its first feeding when Chick 2 fully hatched from its egg. The chicks are considered fully hatched when it's completely free of the egg shell, according to the group. Both hatchings were caught on camera via the Big Bear Eagle Nest Cam, and clips were later posted to the live stream's Facebook account. The nonprofit wrote a message on Facebook congratulating the parents on their two beautiful fluff balls, Jackie and Shadow. Jackie was successfully feeding Chick 1 for the first time when Chick 2 hatched. Shadow, at that time, was away from the nest. Initial feedings are often challenging as the chicks don't have much muscle strength in their necks, the group stated in a post on Facebook that announced the hatching of Chick 2. At this stage, they are often called bobbleheads. Soon after Chick 2 hatched, Shadow returned to the nest. He seemed quite proud and didn't waste any time snuggling in for some daddy duty, according to the group. Jackie and Shadow have been guarding the eggs since Jackie laid them on February 24th and February 27th. That's according to USA Today's previous reporting. The eggs came after tragedy struck during the 2025-2026 breeding season. The couple lost their first clutch of eggs, which were laid in January, after ravens breached the nest. Live streams can be watched on Friends of Big Bear Valley's website at www.friendsofbigbearvalley.org. Viewers can watch the couple care for their chicks from multiple angles via two different live streams on that website. The preservation group set up a webcam in Big Bear Lake Forest almost 10 years ago. Over the years, Jackie and Shadow have grown an internet flock of fans, and there's been plenty of drama, including Shadow chasing off another male back in 2018. The couple welcomed chicks in 2019 and 2022, but lost eggs in 2023 and 24. Then, in 2025, two eaglets survived out of three eggs that were laid. The next story from the U.S. section is headlined, At Least Eight Dead After Series of Police Pursuits Across U.S. A string of high-speed police car chases resulted in at least eight deaths and several injuries over a span of less than a week, marking the latest deadly incidents in an upward trend of police pursuit fatalities in the United States. Early on Sunday, April 5th, police in Texas said a man died early that morning after fleeing from officers and crashing off the roadway. The Montgomery Advisor, which is part of the USA Today network, reported that four people died after a driver attempted to evade a state trooper and struck a tree in rural Alabama last Friday. In Southern California, authorities said three people were killed in separate incidents last week after local law enforcement tried to pursue two suspects who then crashed into other vehicles. Hundreds of people in the U.S. die each year during police pursuits, according to experts and research. The long-standing police practice has faced criticism for years. A study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2024 found that research spanning from 1982 to 2020 suggested an increasing trend in fatalities resulting from police pursuits in this country. In 2023, the Police Executive Research Forum, a police research and policy organization, called high-speed vehicular pursuits one of the most controversial and dangerous police activities. Citing data from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, the report noted that there were more than 2,200 fatal vehicle crashes involving a police pursuit between 2015 and 2020. The report recommended that law enforcement agencies only conduct pursuits when a violent crime has been committed and the suspect poses an imminent threat. The report stated that while officers' decisions to initiate or continue a pursuit are driven by an understandable desire to catch a fleeing suspect, this desire sometimes results in excessive risk-taking and negative consequences for officers, as well as for innocent bystanders, the motorist being pursued, and any passengers who may be in either vehicle. The Fort Worth Police Department said officers were involved in a vehicle pursuit that resulted in a fatal crash at about 2:30 a.m. local time on Easter Sunday. Officers attempted to conduct a traffic stop after seeing a vehicle that had been driving without headlights strike another vehicle on Interstate 35 and fail to stop. The driver fled from officers and then hit another vehicle, according to police. The suspect then exited the highway and later crashed off the highway. Officers were able to locate the vehicle and found two men, including a passenger who sustained minor injuries, and the driver, who was pronounced dead at the scene. Police said the passenger was transported to a local hospital with his injuries. No other injuries were reported in that incident. In Alabama, Captain Jeremy Burkett, a spokesperson for the Alabama Law Enforcement Agency, confirmed to the Montgomery Advertiser that four people died after the driver of a vehicle allegedly tried to evade a state trooper in Pike County. Tykevius Rousseau, who's 27 years old, was driving with three other passengers in a 2022 Hyundai Elantra, Burkett said. He identified passengers as Robert Hall, 27 years old, Kwame Richardson, 24 years old, and a 17-year-old whose name was not publicly released. The incident occurred at around midnight local time on April 3rd, when the vehicle left the roadway and struck a tree while attempting to evade a trooper. Burkett said that Rousseau, Hall, and the 17-year-old were not wearing seatbelts at the time of the crash, causing all three to be ejected from the vehicle. Richardson was the only passenger not ejected, Burkett said. All four passengers in the vehicle were pronounced dead on the scene after that crash. Meanwhile, in Pomona, California, in eastern Los Angeles County, police said a domestic violence suspect who tried to flee from officers crashed into another vehicle on April 1st. The couple inside the bystander vehicle, a 26-year-old man and a 25-year-old woman, were both killed in that incident. Both the Los Angeles Times and CBS News Los Angeles reported that the couple was days away from the birth of their first child. In San Clemente, California, in Orange County, the sheriff's department there said that deputies were attempting to stop a U-Haul van with no license plates that had been reported stolen on March 30th. When deputies tried to stop that vehicle, the sheriff's department said the driver accelerated and collided with an SUV about half a mile away. The driver of that SUV was killed in the crash, and her three passengers were transported to the hospital in critical condition. The suspect ran from deputies and was later arrested, while the passenger of the stolen U-Haul remained at the scene and was also taken into custody. Some sports news now. Last night was the national championship men's collegiate basketball championship game. The story is headlined, Michigan had its worst game this season. how it still won the national title. It's written by USA Today's staff reporter Jordan Mendoza. Dateline Indianapolis. You wouldn't think Michigan would be all smiles at halftime. Yes, it did have a 4-point lead over Connecticut in the national championship game, but it was an unattractive 4-point lead. Arguably, it was the worst first half performance of their season. Not only did the Michigan Wolverines fail to make a single 3-pointer in the first half, the only time that's happened this season, there were no makes outside of the paint. An awful first 20 minutes. But the Wolverines weren't just staying positive, they were beaming with happiness. Why? It can't get any worse, Michigan guard Namari Burnett told USA Today Sports. True, but it's not like the second half was really any better. Michigan struggled offensively for all 40 minutes of the game. The 69 points the Wolverines scored were Michigan's third lowest total of the season. It was their worst 3-point shooting night of the year. Actually, it was the worst shooting performance of the season, period. The University of Connecticut needed to make Michigan look ugly to win. It did that, and UConn still lost. So how did the Wolverines do it? Because of one thing that had been hiding in plain sight. While Michigan was lighting up the scoreboard with its prolific offense all tournament long, it made everyone forget one thing. That is, they're just as good on defense. When one side lets us down, the other side picks it up, said Michigan forward Yaxel Lendeborg. The Wolverines made sure to remind everybody last night, resulting in a national championship, as those halftime smiles carried over to after the buzzer sounded and Lucas Oil Stadium in Indianapolis rained down maize and blue confetti. It's not like Michigan's defensive prowess wasn't there for all to see. Three of the players, Lendeborg, Merez Johnson Jr., and Ade Mara, were Big Ten all-defensive players. Mara was the conference defensive player of the year. That's why team's defensive shooting percentage of 38.4 and average of 6.1 blocks per game were each the second best mark in the country, and it was on full display in the NCAA tournament. The reason why Michigan won its first five tournament games by an average of 21.6 points wasn't just because it was scoring at least 90, but because it harassed opposing offenses in every game. No team playing the Wolverines shot better than 45% in the tournament, and the collective opponent shooting percentage from those games, 38%. The defense got better as the tournament went on. Burnett said, "The statistics speak for themselves. I feel like we're the best defensive team in the country." He proved it, and his teammates did too. UConn shot a season-worst 31% from the field. A team that had been top 10 in assists with more than 18 per game had only 9, the only time it was held to single digits this season. Despite making 9 three-point shots, UConn missed 24 of them. Shots were constantly getting contested by the Wolverines' quickness to the ball. Even with the looks that UConn wanted, not many of them were wide open. It did not get any easier near the basket. 6 shots inside the paint were swatted away, which made it tough for the UConn Huskies to prevail, even with their own defensive toughness. UConn coach Dan Hurley said, "It's hard to have a level of disappointment where literally it just came down to we just didn't make enough shots in the basket. To be able to keep that team under 40% from the field, this team has destroyed everyone they faced in this tournament." For all of its defensive success, Michigan still had to find a way to score, and it did so in a somewhat uncharacteristic way. If there was one thing Michigan wasn't good at, it was free throws. The Wolverines entered the night 109th in the country with just a 74% mark from the free throw line. They drew fouls, resulting in 28 free throw attempts. How many did they make? How about 25 for a 90% clip? All of it proved to be just enough to get their biggest win of the season. "We started off really, really bad offensively," Lendeborg said. Our defense was the reason why we won most of those games. Today, it's the same thing. We had to dig deep. While it certainly wasn't pretty by any means, how Michigan was able to win showed there's nothing to doubt about this title. Since the statement it made at the Players' Era tournament, Michigan had been a relentless machine on both sides of the ball, churning blowout win after blowout win no matter who was on the other side. Even when Michigan isn't able to do that, instead of falling apart like most teams might, the Wolverines opted to home in on one of its many strengths and ride it toward a win. Hurley said, "They're legit. They definitely deserve to win the national championship. They're clearly the best team in the country this year." UConn had hoped for a slugfest, and that's exactly what it got. Michigan's coach, Dusty May, admitted that the Huskies had a masterful game plan to beat us. All of it pointed to a third national title in 4 years that would cement Hurley's dynasty. Little did UConn and the rest of the country realize, however, Michigan had been throwing it down all season, and it didn't need another offensive surge to do that. Defense carried Michigan just as much to this point, and in the end, Michigan proved defense wins championships. Obviously, Burnett said, it's a big stage, but we deserve to be here. We deserve this moment. Here's a story about soccer. Headlined, U.S. MNT striker Patrick Egemang will miss World Cup with Achilles injury. Derby County has confirmed Patrick Egemang suffered a serious Achilles injury in a game against Stoke City on Monday. That injury will see the U.S. men's national team striker miss the World Cup this summer. The club's announcement today was unfortunately not a surprise, as the 25-year-old striker went down with a non-contact injury in the first half of yesterday's game against Stoke and had to be carried off the field on a stretcher. There were immediate fears of an Achilles injury, which proved to be accurate. He will finish his first season at Derby County with 10 goals, making a major impact after joining in a transfer from Charlotte FC last summer. The injury likely won't just rule him out of the World Cup, though. Derby did not specify the severity of the injury or a time frame for a return. He will be undergoing a further assessment of the injury later today, Derby announced this morning. The club added, at this stage, it would be wrong to put a timeline on his recovery. Egemang broke into the U.S. men's national team picture last year, making his first 12 appearances at the international level while scoring 5 goals. After missing out on USMNT rosters in the fall, Egemang was recalled in March and played in both matches against Belgium and Portugal. He scored a late consolation in the team's 5-2 loss to Belgium. The injury will boost the World Cup roster chances of Ricardo Pepi and Haji Wright. Josh Sargent, who has been out of the picture since September, could also have a potential route back onto the team. The National Football League draft comes up later this month. This story is about the likely number one draft pick, Fernando Mendoza. The headline, Mendoza keeps business focus as NFL draft awaits. Of the 300 students that Steve Etter teaches every semester, more than 95%, according to Etter's bestimate, perform financial functions via Microsoft Excel. The vast minority rely on the traditional handwritten method, using formulas, a pencil, and a piece of paper. And those who watched college football last year can easily assume which category Fernando Mendoza falls into. Fernando is a formula guy, Etter said. I guess the way I would say it, he's a throwback. Etter taught Mendoza at the Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley, first in a financial literacy course that's geared toward athletes, and later in a corporate finance class. By now, most people are aware of Mendoza's business acumen and the professional path almost taken. Mendoza used his name, image, and likeness earnings to pay for his final three classes at Haas so he could graduate in 3 years. He pursued a master's degree at Indiana University, the school he led to its first national title last season, while he took home the Heisman Trophy. Now, he's nearly a lock to be the number one pick in the NFL draft by the Las Vegas Raiders. "You could just see it," Etter said. "I saw it early with Fernando. I remember, when he got to Cal, how poised he was. And when you watch that Heisman Trophy speech, he practiced his craft in the classroom, in the locker room, on the field, where he developed a presence over time. He had a mission that you could see his eyes on, and everything he did was to get to that moment." Of course, there was the alternate reality in which Cal never offered him a scholarship, and Mendoza stuck to his plan of attending Yale. Maybe the NFL still would have been an option, but what would have been more likely, Mendoza said, was a career path in finance that would have started him off on Wall Street as an analyst. "First of all," Mendoza told us, "I think it would have been a very cool experience to be around people who are a lot smarter than me and make friends with those people, just like I did at Berkeley." During the college football playoff, Mendoza confirmed that a LinkedIn account that had gone viral, the internships were legit and included his football captaincies, actually did belong to him. It remains his lone form of social media. "I think there's a lot of value in financial careers," he said. "Not only are you able to support and provide for your family, you can also change other people's lives, like U.S. Bank does." Mendoza spoke to USA Today Sports through a partnership with U.S. Bank and its Financial Edge program. Helping people maximize financial growth is rewarding to Mendoza. With his pro football career about to start and one foot dipped into the financial space, he has what he calls the best of both worlds with this current role. "Who knows," he said, "maybe in the future, after football, there can be a career with that." Mendoza has leaned on mentors to help him find success both on and off the football field. The best business advice, Mendoza, who completed 72% of his throws for 3,535 yards and 41 touchdowns last season, has heard is also what football coaches like to espouse: have a growth mindset. "Financial literacy," he said, "it changes every single day." Doing things the old-fashioned way, by the book, became Mendoza's calling card at Cal, Etter said. He led group meetings and performed his part even as the so-called big man on campus and the Golden Bears' starting quarterback. Etter said Mendoza is somebody who is passionate about his Cuban heritage, his faith, the people around him, and business. Etter said, "The four legs of the Fernando chair, the human being you see and ask yourself, is this guy real? And the answer is, yeah, everything is genuine and from inside." Mendoza doesn't avoid attention. He absorbs the publicity that comes with being a Heisman winner and eventual NFL franchise quarterback without it affecting his attitude toward others, Etter said, which creates a level of trust and confidence among his colleagues. "A lot of people are out to get notoriety," Etter said, "and try to expand their brand through social media and marketing. I see Fernando focused on himself, not focused on his brand. He worries about himself." The money that Mendoza made from his name, image, and likeness deals helped him finish his Berkeley degree, and he also paid for biomedical scans. Other than that, he famously does not spend money on himself. "My mindset is that if I can invest in the market and invest in myself, whatever that return may be, not only in the market, but also in my growth and development, I think that's the best investment I can make," Mendoza said. At Cal, Mendoza had a pair of internships. On top of his football responsibilities, it felt like he was balancing two jobs. His optimistic, happy-go-lucky attitude helped him once he realized that his internship was actually an interview for a full-time job sometime down the line. Once, during the summer, he worked for a commercial real estate firm and was asked to run data on an Excel spreadsheet. The specifics of the request, however, he underestimated. What Mendoza thought would be an easy task turned into an all-night assignment. Mendoza likes to think about inputs and outputs, which is why ROI, return on investment, is his favorite financial acronym. His favorite Excel trick is also relatively rudimentary, VLOOKUP. Sometimes, Mendoza said, you gotta check it down. Here's a story about last night's Red Sox game, headlined, Fireworks at Fenway. Milwaukee Brewers feud continues at Fenway Park. It's written by Kurt Hogg, who's a writer for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It transcends jersey color, roster construction, what year it is, and whoever happens to be on the mound. When Wilson Contreras plays the Milwaukee Brewers, he's going to get mad. The latest chapter in what has become a decades-long inevitability between player and opponent occurred last night at Fenway Park. Contreras, who now is with the Red Sox, was wearing different colors from each of the previous interdivisional spats with Milwaukee, but it actually looked the same as each of those prior phases. A Brewers pitcher hit Contreras, and he did not appreciate it. The fireworks at Fenway occurred in the third inning, when a sinker from Brandon Woodruff grazed the top of Contreras' hand, though the visiting side, including Wilson's younger brother and Brewers catcher William Contreras, thought otherwise. The pitch was high, but not in, just off the plate to the inside by a couple of inches. The first baseman immediately slammed his bat in frustration and began taking steps toward the pitcher's mound before redirecting his path toward first base. All the while, he harped toward Woodruff. That's how he plays, said William Contreras of his brother. This was not just a one-off, however. There's history there. Plenty of it. It was the 24th time that Contreras had been hit by the Brewers in 121 games, and the sixth time that Woodruff had hit him. Both facts that were quickly brought up following the Brewers' 8-6 win over the Red Sox. The 33-year-old Contreras has long viewed it as purposeful by the Brewers, dating back to even the days of Craig Counsell as manager, when Milwaukee and the Chicago Cubs played dozens of fierce games over the years. Contreras said, it's not just getting hit by the pitch. It's the 24th pitch they've hit me with in my career. 24th. It's the sixth time Woodruff has hit me. They always say, I'm not trying to hit you. That gets old. On the other side, the Brewers insist they aren't trying to hit Contreras, but rather it's a byproduct of playing so often over the years and his proclivity to lean over the plate. Contreras, after all, is plunk-prone. He ranks second among active players in Major League Baseball in being hit by a pitch. To relitigate all the hit-by-pitches and, in most cases, the ensuing dust-ups, would be a task too arduous for this space, but there are many. They date back to his tenure with the Cubs, which began in 2016, and up until this night in Boston, the most recent encounter was last June. There has been strife over more than just being hit by pitch, too. Last year, Rhys Hoskins got into it with Contreras over what the Brewers perceived to be a dirty play at first base involving his now Red Sox teammate, Caleb Durbin. Some in the Brewers clubhouse also quietly stewed about Contreras stepping out of the box and onto home plate as pitcher Jacob Mizorowski delivered a pitch to try and throw him off during Mizorowski's Major League debut last year. Safe to say, the Brewers are over it. We've seen that skit for the last 10 years, outfielder Christian Yelich said. It's nothing new. Wilson Contreras, however, is not over it. Next time they hit me, again, I'm going to take one of them out, he said. That's the message. The ordeal puts the younger Contreras in a difficult spot, effectively having to choose between his brother and his team whenever the two sides play. But William is leaving no questions as to where his allegiances lie when the dust flies up during the game. He's my brother. After we leave the stadium, William said. William attempted to calm Wilson down once again after the Woodruff pit by pitch, but to no avail. "I tried," the little brother said, "but it's impossible." Wilson continued barking toward the mound after getting to first base, only stopping because he had to run two pitches later to second base, where he went in with his cleats high and took a chunk of shortstop David Hamilton's pant leg with him. "We've been through this. It's what, 9 years for me? It seems like every year," pitcher Woodruff said. "He's trying to play a game, and he's trying to get his side fired up. Once I knew what was going on, I wasn't going to let it affect me on the mound. I knew I had a job to do. I knew the pitch count was still down, even though I had given up a few runs, and I knew the bullpen was short, so I know I needed to go out there and just keep competing." Contreras, who continued to be riled up, kept burning the Brewers with his bat, however, as the game went on, getting a hit in each of his next three trips to the plate, including a mammoth solo home run in the ninth inning. The Brewers, though, did get the final word in the series opener. "That was a great win," Yelich said. "It was a toughness win from the guys. We got down early. It was cold out there. We got a short bullpen, and we found a way to win. We're willing to grind with anybody. Just really proud of the guys for stepping up and finding a way there, just willing it. Now, we wait and see what's next. Two more games remain in the series." The series, story from the USA Today Health section. New cases of deadly bacterial disease alarm doctors. It's written by Eduardo Cuevas of the USA Today staff. A handful of children have been hospitalized for a potentially deadly bacterial infection, alarming doctors about the possible return of a once-feared contagious disease that vaccines had tamed. Serious cases of Haemophilus influenzae type B, or HIB, once impacted 20,000 children in the U.S. each year. It's a disease that spreads through coughing or sneezing with respiratory droplets containing bacteria. Invasive infection included infants and toddlers who developed pneumonia, meningitis, septic arthritis, blood infection, and swelling in the throat, causing, in some cases, permanent disability and death in around 1,000 children annually. Older physicians have haunting memories of severe illnesses they saw, of brain swelling and even children suffocating. The HIB vaccine, introduced more than 30 years ago and now recommended for all children younger than the age of 5, drastically reduced cases, preventing nearly all vaccinated children from developing it. Infants received 3 or 4 vaccine doses beginning at 2 months old. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports today fewer than 50 cases per year, a reduction of more than 99%. But as more parents begin to skip routine vaccinations of their children, doctors worry HIB cases will return in force. 2 severe cases in a Florida beach community hospital in 2025 and another 2 cases presented at a Tennessee research institution are causing concern. "If this was something adults would get, you'd see a lot of people panicking," said Dr. Ehab Kanawi, a pediatrician in Panama City, Florida. That's a tourist destination where the local hospital saw 2 severe cases in intensive care within 6 months last year. One was an unvaccinated 4-month-old child who died. Another was a 2-year-old, also unvaccinated, who had brain abscesses and seizures and has had lasting health effects. Dr. Kanawi, who didn't personally treat the cases but was on call at the time, first alerted the State Department of Health rulemaking conference in Florida of the cases in December. Both children were visiting Florida from out of state, making it difficult to know how prevalent HIB was in that area. Health experts worry about undetected spread, especially among cuts to CDC surveillance and reporting to detect diseases like HIB. "What's really going on?" said Dr. Paul Offit, who's the director of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia's Vaccine Education Center. He wrote a blog post titled "The Return of HIB" last March. "This is not a disease you want to come back. CDC is not seeing an increase in preventable invasive HIB infections among children, according to Andrew Nixon, a spokesperson for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. As of March 28th, the latest CDC surveillance data showed only 8 cases this year. Dozens of states have expansive vaccine exemptions for religion and personal beliefs. Florida is looking to end school entry vaccinations, including for HIV. Reductions in vaccinations have already contributed to the rapid resurgence of measles outbreaks across the country. If we choose not to vaccinate, there are a number of serious diseases that children can acquire, according to Dr. Catherine Edwards, a vaccine safety expert and pediatrics professor emerita at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Tennessee. Doctors there recently saw 2 cases of HIV. Dr. Edwards said parents need to know that and doctors need to remember. Since the vaccine nearly eliminated the disease, physicians today may not look for signs of infection in a child. We've brought it down to pretty much zero in the country, said Dr. Mathuram Santosham, professor of pediatrics and international health at Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health. He, like Edwards, worked to pioneer the first HIV vaccines in the 1980s. It's frightening, not only for HIV, but for other diseases as well, he said. It's just crazy that we're going backwards on these vaccine-preventable diseases, said Dr. Philip Wong, who's director of the Dallas County Health and Human Services in Texas. Back in Florida, Kanawi, a doctor for 27 years, has never seen the bacterial infection, but he now has to consider that a fever, which is common among children, might be a symptom of something much worse. I now have to think that way, he said. That's all for USA Today. For Thursday, April 7th, I'm Scott. It's been a pleasure being with you.